This is Jack Danger. Recently, just recently, Lewis and Clark College celebrated their 30th year of doing the Gender Symposium, which is the time to talk about gender roles, exploding gender roles, focusing on some complex questions and hopefully coming up with complex answers. And if you're going to talk about gender in the last 10 or so years, you really can't have a Gender Symposium without inviting Kate Bornstein to come and talk. Kate Bornstein, you know, whenever you say Kate Bornstein, I think, well, everybody knows her, you know, but it turns out, you know, you can't be snotty like that. So I like to get a little commas after your names, little parentheses. Kate Bornstein is a transgender activist, performance artist, written a bunch of books, Gender Outlaw, that Roadkill, another one.
My Gender Workbook.
Yeah, I was coming to that.
I knew you knew that.
Then I have to explain the whole thing. It's just a drag. You get tired explaining the whole thing?
No, it's, as you say, a drag.
I made a
joke! You did!
I made a joke!
You're the best.
Yeah. I just threw your pencil. But do you always feel like you start by saying, hi, I'm Kate Bornstein, and I used to be Al? Or do you? How do you work this
now? You remembered Al. Oh, my God. Hey, don't you remember? They called me Al.
Right.
It was Al all the time. I love being on the radio.
You
with
do, don't
Jack.
You?
I really
yeah.
do.
Okay. Do you me. Get tired of saying, and hi, I'm Kate Bornstein, and...
No, you know what I've learned how to say now, which really gets under some people's skin? Of course, not your listeners,
no.
but
maybe.
I say Kate Bornstein, Kate Bornstein, and they go, okay, and I say, and I'm not a man, and I'm not a woman.
That annoys people.
It does, because they want to hear, then, what are you? And I don't know. I don't have an answer for that one.
So we could, to make it easier on people who may not have been following the Kate Bornstein Chronicles... we could say Kate Bornstein was actually born with the genitals that traditionally culture says, oh, look, it's a penis, it's a boy.
Right.
And baby Bornstein lived his life as a boy for many years. Became a man Bornstein.
I was a manly man.
A manly man, because you're like 7'5". thereabouts. You're six
no.
something.
I am. I'm like 6 foot even, pretty much.
Yeah, that's you're like a premium presence. So Al Bornstein was like a presence. And then one day Al woke up and said, not working for me.
Now, Al woke up and when Al was 4 or 5 years old and said, this isn't working, and I've tried to make it work for a long, long time.
Were you a sissy boy?
Oh, not at all. No. I was good, because I'm an actor, right?
Well, not when
and
you were six. You were an actor.
Yeah. You learn how to act really well so that people don't look at you like you're a freak. And I could pass as a real guy. And
played sports, scratches?
No, none of that. None of that.
Did
but,
you do that?
But
no.
I got away with that because I was Jewish, see? And Jewish boys are not supposed to play sports. We're supposed to be eggheads.
Thinkins.
Yeah.
Right, were you, so you're intellectual, academic, chess-playing, manly man?
No.
Manly man?
I was a hippie boy.
Hippie boy.
And
all right.
Then from hippie boy, I joined the ranks of the Church of Scientology.
That's a natural step.
Well, it's a little more embarrassing than admitting I'm transsexual, but a lot more embarrassing.
Two words, Tom Cruise.
Oh, I know, Tom.
I know.
Love that South Park episode, Come Out of the Closet, Tom.
Yeah, well, we're waiting for that. All right, so you became a Scientologist.
I stayed there for a long time because it was one of the instances of joining a club that would never have me as a member.
So they didn't really care.
Oh, they cared a lot. They wanted to cure me, and I wanted to be cured. And it was,
you told them that you thought you were...
A transsexual, I said. I've always wanted to be a woman because there was no other options
right.
when I was growing up. And I did. I always wanted to walk through the world girly girl. And that was not nice in their books. I finally left the Church of Scientology and decided to say, all right, now I've got to pursue this. And so I went into therapy, and quick as a bunny, maybe 2-3 years later, I came out the other side, minus those that penis and testicles you were talking about earlier. Well, I still have penis and testicles. Mine are innies now, not outies.
Okay, so now you're a woman. You go through the street, and people go, hey, look at that cool, long, tall, cool drinking blonde. They go and they open the door for you, and they do all those things that culture tells women should be treated. Not happy. No, Kate's not happy with that.
No.
Didn't like him when she had a penis. Didn't like him when she didn't have a penis. Now what?
Well, it was just a matter of I had to lie as much when I was a woman as I felt I had to lie when I was a boy and a man. It was just I just wasn't able to say, hey, look, this is who I am. I like walking around the world as a long, tall drink of water. That's
blonde. Okay,
yes.
You like that?
I like that. It's fun for me. I love flirting with butches. Butches are my favorite things.
I know that song. These are a few of my favorite things.
And that would include, and most especially you, Jack
she
Danger.
Says everyone that into
no, I don't.
Right.
I don't.
Is it getting hot in here? All right, move along.
Anyway, so that's what I enjoy doing, but it doesn't mean I'm a woman. It doesn't mean I'm female. It just means I'm me expressing myself the way I've always wanted to express myself. And when I started to say that, people started to say, oh, that's very postmodern of you. And then I had to quick look that up in a dictionary and go, what does that mean? 'Cause postmodernism is sort of Western culture's way of saying paradoxical. Things can be more than what they appear to be. Or less than what they appear to be. Like, the ceiling above you right now is also the floor of the room above you. So it's a ceiling and a floor at the same time. It's very Zen, and I kind of liked it from that, because I was always into the Zen, the beat poets, a long time ago.
So, Kate, so you must piss off a lot of people, because we look for spokespeople, we look for people that will help us articulate some of the confusion that goes through our brain, and at one point you were the transgendered, in that day, M to F sort of spokesperson. And now I think I heard it referred to, people getting mad at you because you brought up the whole third, the thirdness. So could you have been the person you are, could be articulated the things that you're articulating, be the spokesperson, your speaking person eyes, if you hadn't changed your genitals? Was that necessary to be Kate Bornstein? Well, of course, the Kate part. When you look back and say, you know, I could have done this as Al.
I do look back and I say that. And I'm fortunate that I'm happy with the results of my genital surgery. When I was going through it, I had no concept of neither nor. I thought, okay, I believe the doctors. My father was a doctor, so I like bow down, yes sir, three bags full, sir, to the medical profession, the Western medical profession. They said, okay, you're not a man, you're going to be a woman, here's the way you're going to go, surgery. You know, go surgery, young man. So I said, okay, great, and I'll come out the other side all whoop-de-doodles. And I didn't. What I resent is that I did not have the option. And I think that's what's missing in the tranny world, is the notion of options. You know, even now with the female-to-male explosion that's going on right now.
Don't get me started.
Please,
where start. Are all the butches?
Now look, I am in love.
It's your fault.
It's not either. I'm in love with F to M's as much as I love butches, but I keep looking for butches, and butches come and go, and
they go.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about that. I am challenged by some things. I think, you know, you talk about gender defenders, which is a term I really, really like. You know, it's like, because we do get stuck in these rigid roles, but I find it more revolutionary to say, okay, I'm a woman, I have a vagina, I'm a woman. I don't even think about it. And it's good that people think about it, because I don't. But I'm going to do whatever I want to do. There's nothing I cannot do except urinate. Standing up has been a real challenge for me. I've had to change my clothes many times to try to do that. I'm sorry. It's true. But there's not many things I can't do as a woman. Why do we have to think about changing genders? I'm stuttering. Say we're a man. Just be the woman that you can just be everything. Come on, help me out here.
Boy, oh golly. I don't understand.
Boy, oh golly?
Stop it.
Okay. Why can't I just be a woman?
You can. Of course you can.
And that's more revolutionary.
Any butch woman can be. And butch doesn't necessarily, of course, mean lesbian or dyke. It just means a more masculine presentation, traditionally masculine. If people knew, if this wasn't radio and people could see how bloody handsome you are.
And how bloody beautiful you are. I love the little giggle.
Yeah, well.
But I don't. That's the point I don't get. I get confused about. And I looked at your schedule on your website, twotallblondes.com. You are speaking everywhere. Universities all over the country are having you to come talk to them. What do you say? Do you say you can? You don't have to be transgendered? You can just bust through the rigid roles and revolutionize the world?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Transgender is now passé. I wrote at the end of Gender Outlaw, I said, I would love if I could, you know, before I die, I could see this stuff become old.
Yeah.
And it has. That's the cool thing about it. Transgender, going from one to another. The way I did, I am M to F. Now, no matter where I went after that, I'll always be M to F because I walk around in the world as F. That's what I like to do. But this whole thing of gender queer now is permitting more and more butch women to simply exist as butch women. The peer pressure within the female-to-male community and butch/butch community is really hard, though. When a butch woman comes out as a butch woman, say, hey, I'm butch, and immediately, in most areas, gets asked, well, good, when are you going to start testosterone? Ow, ow. Genderqueer isn't like that. Genderqueer is cool. Whatever you want. Whatever you want. And a butch woman might on Tuesdays decide to wear a pink tutu. Just for
who
the hell of it.
You?
I wasn't going to say on the radio.
Okay, good. I paid you a lot of money not to say. But what about the women who want butch? What about women who just don't identify that way and just want to be, they don't want to be bound by any kind of cultural paradigms or what it means to be a woman?
They mostly don't live in major metropolitan areas anymore. I run into butch women in the heartland. I run into butch women in the southeast U.S. I run into a lot of butch women in more rural areas. Butches. Real live butches.
They're man Hank.
Well, some of them with their man Hank, and some of them with, you know, their girlfriend Betty, their femme girlfriends.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, yay, that's what it's about. And, you know, let me plug Leslie Feinberg's Stone Butch Blues. You know, weep a minute, read, but you want to find out what butch means, what butch woman means. That's an excellent introduction, I think.
That's a serious butch. There's a whole spectrum of butch.
That was a serious butch.
Yeah. Okay, so man to woman, and now you prefer no gender.
Yeah.
Do you register to vote?
I do.
And you check?
I check female.
I go, oh, yuck.
Exactly. Yeah. And I can't get on most websites without checking, you know, male or female.
Yeah.
Although some are saying other. And there are some colleges now with their admissions forms, they're saying, you know, check one, male, female. And some will say other. Some will say transgender M to F, transgender F, you know,
really?
F to M. Yeah, it's starting to change. That's kind of cool.
That isn't cool.
But most insurance companies, no insurance company will admit that. You have to say what your gender is.
You wrote Gender Outlaw in the 90s. Ish.
94, was
94,
it?
I believe.
I think so.
So that would be 12 years ago. You've been touring, you've been doing your performance art, you've been writing, you've been speaking. Tell me about the climate change that you've seen with mostly college students, because that's where you mostly speak.
Yeah.
Are the same questions? Are you seeing more people coming to you and say, you know, you changed my life and now I'm doing this? Is it more open? Tell me about it.
Let's get back to this nasty word of postmodern. Postmodernism was being taught well before my book was out, and postmodern theories of gender were being taught well before my book was coming out, notably by Judith Butler and some other academics. I just wrote it in a more
user-friendly.
Yeah, I was the Mac to their PC.
Absolutely.
Okay. Which does, well, I am
good.
A Mac fan.
Yeah.
But since it became user-friendly, since there was an easier language to describe it, now it could be talked about rather than simply written about. So the kind of questions I'm getting are going beyond that. Now it's a given. Now it's a given that gender is primarily a social construction, that real men and real women vary according to each culture and subculture. They all have their own rules about what a real man is, what a real woman is, what real sex is, what real desire is, what you're allowed to do. And people are taking that as, well, more and more understood. What has changed negatively since 9/11 is this horrific government that has sprung up in the name of defense of this country and the sex negativism that it's been promoting. So I'm not talking so much about gender these days as I am talking about good old sex. And this is heartening to a lot of students on a lot of campuses. I'm sure that many of their boards of directors wouldn't bring me if they thought I was going to talk about that. So I talk a lot about gender as an introduction, but then I say, all right, now what are you going to do with your gender? Gender in our culture is primarily an indicator of desire or how much power you have in the world. When you play with gender, you're either saying, this is who I want to attract, or this is how powerful I can be, or how undangerous I want to be. So kids get that. Kids get that real easily. But they're growing up in a world where sex is bad.
Wait, hold that thought.
Okay.
So gender and sex. You say people, you know, playing with gender, I'm powerful, I'm not going to be powerful, I'm going to do this. How do you make that leap to sex? Are you talking about the actual act of sex, having sex?
Yeah. Well, sex, the erotic energy, can be in play with...
Excuse me. The erotic energy? I wish I had thrown that pencil away.
Erotic.
Oh, I thought you said theoretic.
Oh, theoretic. Wouldn't that be a good thing?
So
yes.
Okay, so erotic energy.
Erotic energy, yeah. And I know that sex gets used to mean biological gender. I never use it like that. I think that's a big mistake to use sex to mean biological gender and the erotic energy.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So you
When I say sex, I mean...
Having sex, doing sex.
Doing sex. And that's what people aren't talking about. That's what people, sadly, are having to hide more and more and more.
You think that's true?
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. So... So colleges pay you a lot of money to come talk. They give you sweatshirts, and they say you're a keynote, and all of a sudden you're talking about getting laid?
Yeah, a lot. That's pretty much what I'm talking about. Because, you know, that's all... Boy, you've got all that, erotic energy going on. And if you're going to play with gender, which does seem to be key to who you want to attract and who you're attracted to and how, you know, like what kind of tail feathers you're going to put on for the day. Why not have some fun with the sex part of it?
Well, you know, Audre Lorde wrote that great essay on the power of erotica and talked about how powerful that whole thing is.
Tell me more about that, please, because I am illiterate.
Oh, I'll have to send it to you.
Will you?
I will.
Great.
I took care of that, didn't we?
Thank you.
So, the power of the erotic power has been definitely something that people have talked about and written about. How does that tie up with you? So do you just skip over
the transgender? Oh, I do like getting tied up. And
okay.
But that's another story.
One for Kate. Okay. I want to go back to the transgender thing for a second. You no longer, I always want to be respectful, yet just a little rude. pronouns.
Well, this is Per Fagren, KBOO News and Public Affairs, and our guest is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who is an American Indian activist and historian. And she will be appearing Thursday night at the First Unitarian Church at 1011 Southwest 12th, and that'll be in the Salmon Street Sanctuary, Thursday night at 7:30. And she has just written a book called Blood on the Water, which is the third volume of her memoirs, and it deals with the war against the Sandinistas. Roxanne, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm really happy to be with you.
You know, it's reading your book, it just brought back a lot of memories. I'm old enough to remember that war, but, you know, they're thinking a lot of people, you know, were not even around when that war was going on, or else they remember very little about it. So why don't you kind of fill us in a little bit what the issues were, especially relating to the Miskito Indians.
Yes, not only were a lot of people not even born yet who should know about this, but many people from that time have sort of forgotten or, you know, are no longer interested in it. So that's why I think it's so important to understand, you know, what's happening today, that this was a sort of warm-up or prelude for it. The Sandinistas took power, overthrowing a U.S. Installed dictator in 1979. That dictator was one of three of the Somoza family who had been in power for since the U.S. Marines installed the first one in 1933. So it was a long, long time that people lived under that repression with this murderous National Guard that the only enemy was the people themselves. They didn't even have an army just to repress the people. And that's because in the 1920s, there had been a revolutionary movement under Sandino to force the U.S. Marines to leave. They had been occupying there for more than a decade, and also to force out the U.S. companies, the banana company that was had taken over the whole territory of where the Miskito Indians in their territory and completely destroyed the old growth forest of mahogany and planted pine trees and bananas, and really turned the Miskito Indians into a kind of semi-slave population, working and also working in the gold mines, completely wrecking that whole area. It's still a mess because of the environmental destruction of those companies. Well, the revolution was defeated, and the U.S. Marines left, but they left. They had trained the National Guard and left a dictator. And so the second Sandinistas, who began forming in the 1950s, finally grew into a mass insurrection, mass uprising. Happened in 1978, and Somoza started bombing cities and villages to put down the mass uprising. And all the time, the Sandinistas were moving toward the cities and circling the cities and took over. So President Carter in the United States, just as he did the Shah of Iran the following year, gave him, you know, safe leave and flew him out of the country. So the Sandinistas took power. And they had all kind. They were. I knew many of them because there was such a large Nicaraguan population in San Francisco. And most of the population in San Francisco were descendants of the first Sandinistas. Their families had left after Somoza took over because they would have been punished, and the United States sort of easily allowed them to come to the United States because it was in their interest to keep this dictator in power and kind of get rid of the militants. And so San Francisco had a very large, in fact, it was the largest Latino population in San Francisco at the time, and they were almost all descendants of the early Sandinistas. So they were very mobilized to support the, so it seemed like, you know, the revolution was going on here in the United States too, parades, plus these Nicaraguans were involved in all of the 60s, you know, and the San Francisco State Uprising, everything that was called Chicano in San Francisco was mostly Nicaraguans.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Chicanos, like Alejandro Murguia, who were involved in the revolution, they were almost all involved with the Sandinistas as well. So I knew a lot of them, and I knew, and then others came to visit, others who were in exile and leaders, and I just knew them as poets, as really decent human beings. Most of them were blue collar workers. A lot of the trade union leaders, like the SIU, the hotel workers, the culinary workers, they were just filled with these Nicaraguans. And one of the head of the culinary workers union was a Nicaraguan, Walter Ferretti, who became the chief of police of Managua.
And how did the Sandinistas get in a dispute with the Miskito Indians?
Well, when they came to power, they had, even though Sandino had been based in the Miskito area,
which is the east coast of Nicaragua.
The northeast, yes. Mm-hmm. On the Caribbean, which the Nicaraguans call the Atlantic coast for reasons I've never figured out. But anyway, they're way over there, plus a very large Afro-Caribbean population who came from Jamaica to work in the banana fields and from and were descendants, many of them descendants of the Marooners. So there's a large, they call themselves Creoles, a large English-speaking Creole population. And the Sandinistas were mostly unfamiliar with that area except for smuggling weapons in. They used the old drug routes. It was a very corrupt, Somoza's regime was very corrupt. And there was a drug route, and mostly Miskitos and the Creoles were involved in smuggling drugs through there. And so the a major Sandinista, Comandante Lumberto Campbell, who was from Bluefields, the southern part of that area, the Creole part, he organized the drug smugglers to bring in arms as well. So that was not, political organizing of any kind. It was just opportunist organizing. So they really, the only Miskitos and Creoles, like Humberto Campbell, who were Sandinistas and very organized, had been at the university, had been students. Humberto himself had been a professor of mathematics at the National University. And many of his students were Creoles and Miskitos. So the main Sandinista Miskito leaders had been in León for quite a while, and were very militant Sandinistas, but not in their own region. They hadn't been out organizing their own people. So after the revolution, they were the ones, they were the Sandinistas, the Miskito Sandinistas, who were to go and organize their own people. And they were idealistic. They had lots of ideas. And so the first mistakes, and it's often not understood, the first mistakes were made by Miskitos Sandinistas, not Latino mestizo Sandinistas who came in and gave orders. It was these young people, and I know them all, and they're very good people. But there was one among them who was a Stedman faggot, who was soon discovered to have been a Somoza plant. And he was, he was very charismatic. He became the most charismatic leader of the, you know, he didn't pose himself as an anti-Sandinista at first. But what he was doing, everything that those young Mosquitos asked for, like this illiteracy campaign be in Mosquito, the Mosquito language. And what happened from that is that the Sandinistas recognized all of the languages in the country as official languages, and that everyone had the basic human right to their mother tongue, which was extraordinary, you know, for anywhere in the world. In Africa, they do that a lot, but certainly not in the Western Hemisphere. And so they, but Stedman Faggett, who was appointed the leader of this new organization, Misericata, would tell the people, go into the communities and tell them the Sandinistas were terrible, and he was protecting them from the Sandinistas, and that without him, they wouldn't have gotten this. Well, you know, sort of like a politician does, but he was also in touch with, you know, with the CIA, which was organizing across the border and beginning to train, you know, the what became known as the Contras.
So eventually he got a lot of the Indians to leave and cross a border in Honduras.
Yes, 5,000 to leave and cross the border to those camps, 5,000 young Mosquito men. He was very charismatic, and that's how he was organizing. The other mistake they made, I mean, honest mistake that had nothing to do with Stedman Faggett, was there was already a Mosquito, an indigenous organization there on the coast. And I had met them. They first were founded in 1974, about the same time as the International Indian Treaty Council and others. This was the an offshoot of the Vatican II liberation theology, where missionaries were told to organize for liberation rather than simply conversion. And except for the very right-wing evangelical churches, this is a powerful change. And so the churches in the region, the highly missionized, mostly Protestant, but also Catholic, U.S. Catholics, by the way, Capuchins from Wisconsin, they had supported the organizing of Alpumismo, which was called the Alliance for Progress of the Mosquitos, Somos, and the Somos are the other Indian group there. And this was a very popular organization. I met them at our first international indigenous conference at the UN in Geneva in 1977 that I helped organize. And there were three there, three Mosquitos there, and only one of them became a Contra. And he was very suspicious at the time. They didn't talk much about Somoza or the political situation there, because it was very clear it was 1977, you know, that they would be punished, you know, if they went back. So on the side, I talked to, became friends with the two that didn't become Contras. The other guy, Armstrong Wiggins, became a major figure, still is. He's the Indian Law Resource Center in Washington, D.C., took him in, and he's now director of that organization.
But eventually this has sort of split the American Indian movement, too, didn't it?
Absolutely. The Misericata, the new, these young Mosquitos hold the Sandinistas, you have to get rid of Alpermeso, you know, because it was a different, completely different setup. It's a Somocista organization, and create a new organization, which they were the leaders. So that was a really mistake, you know, to get rid of the old organization.
Mm-hmm. But then the CIA jumped in and really took full advantage of these mistakes. And
exactly.
And, they organized these Indians into Contra fighters, too, didn't they? Can you tell us a little bit about that, how the American Indian movement was split?
Well, it started really early with the Akwesasne Notes that used to be the major newspaper on Native American issues. It was a wonderful newspaper back in the 60s and 70s under Wari Horquitz, the author, and he got pushed out in the early 70s. He was a white man, a Canadian, a really dear person. I mean, he still does a lot in Canada. He was adopted by the Mohawks, but then a new generation, not new generation, but a sort of militant group of Mohawks pushed him out and took over the newspaper. And so it was under the editorship of John Mohawk and a Cuban American who claims to be, he claims to be some kind of Indian from Cuba, but he's really basically just a Cusano. and so that was Jose Barriado is his name. So they began very early, I mean, very suspiciously early. It turns out they were being informed by these Contras, publishing articles. They were deeply anti-communist, so publishing art, pretty much just picking up on the Reagan administration's propaganda that this is a Marxist country, and assuming that indigenous people would be bad off. Now, this was the first country where Marxists and most of the Sandinistas were, had taken over in the Western Hemisphere. Unless you count Allende, which I guess, you know, they didn't know much about or whatever, but the Mapuches really, really benefited under Allende and then really suffered under Pinochet, and the Mapuches were very supportive of Allende. So it's just not true, you know, that a socialist government is necessarily anti-indigenous. But with Jose Barriado, you know, being anti-Cuban and, you know, that being his main thing, he just started this propaganda in this major magazine for indigenous peoples that everyone read, setting it up that something terrible was going to happen to the indigenous peoples. So he seemed to be getting his information directly from Armstrong Wiggins, and he started publishing things like that. So that started actually in early 1980, 6 months after the Sandinista Revolution. Those kinds of articles began. And that's when I realized I should... And it was disturbing, you know. I didn't know for sure. My friends here were mostly down there. And Marxists are not. You know, the indigenous people can suffer under various governments. So I... But that year I was living in New York and doing a book on how the UN might be useful for indigenous peoples. And I was in touch with the mission of the Nicaraguan mission. And they said, this isn't true. There have been some problems, and they described the dissolving of Alpermeso. And then in February 1981, when I was still in New York, the Stedman Faggot led the 5,000 young men over into Honduras. And they said, you know, you just need to go down there and see for yourself and talk to people that there is no, you know, there's, it's a part of this contra-organizing.
Mm-hmm. So when you did go down there, and then when you try to get the word, you were severely criticized by, I don't know, I think of the U.S. propaganda machine, you know, sort of sometimes called the mighty Wurlitzer, you know. I mean, they just go full blast all kinds of media outlets. And so you were really kind of severely criticized, weren't you?
Well, not at that level, because mm-hmm. the way the Reagan administration's contra war was working, you know, they had this Office of Public Diplomacy. They really did work through the Indian movement, the larger Indian movement, not the American Indian movement per se, but in there too, for me to be attacked and discredited there, you know, because I was basically trying to get my message to the to movement people, both, you know, the left in general, solidarity movement, and to the Native movement, because the Contra War was not popular in the United States. It was never popular, and huge delegations went down all the time. But this propaganda about the Indians began to make people doubt. So people in the Solidarity movement, people in the Native American movement, and it did start diminishing, you know, support for the Contra War as more and more of this got out. So since I was the only person who had gone down there and who was in the Indian movement, there was an anthropologist, Philip Bourgeois. And he also worked to, you know, bring this to the left, to the Latin American Studies Association. We did all kinds of work to bring this information within. You know, we didn't really need, the major media was attacking, but I was never, ever able, although I tried to get those reporters down there, Stephen Kinzer and Julia Preston and all of them, to, I don't know, interview me or whatever, because they didn't know whether they could trust me or not, because all the information they were getting about the Indian point of view was that I was not a credible voice.
Yeah, I guess maybe we should jump forward now, because what happened after all that was, of course, that the Sandinistas, they won one election, I guess, in 84, and then they lost another one. The sort of Sandinistas, you know, we're going to continue the war, and you're not going to get any aid, and that's when Violeta Chamorro. In 2006, Daniel Ortega is still around, Sandinistas are still around. It's possible that the tide seems to be turning in Latin America in some ways with Hugo Chavez.
Yes, it does, with Evo Morales and Kirchner in Argentina, and hopefully this will have an effect. But, you know, as a Latin American historian, when I look at when the United States crushes countries, as it did Nicaragua and, of course, the movement in El Salvador and Guatemala, it takes so long to recover. And I mean, that's true of, you know, all over, I mean, like Chile. And, Ernesto Cardenal, Nicaraguan poet, has said recently that he thinks that there's no hope in, you know, the foreseeable future for Central America, especially for Nicaragua, because of that. But it's hard to tell because, you know, this the reverberations of what's going on in Latin America, and especially if Obrador, the leftist, wins in Mexico, this will have a heartening effect, I think, on Central America. If Daniel Ortega may actually win, the elections this fall.
Mm-hmm.
But he sort of left. He has definitely lost his revolutionary edge.
Probably.
Is accused of all kinds of things that make him a dubious person. Mm-hmm. I think it would be better than not if he were elected. At least something would start happening.
Well, hopefully younger people will come along also. I think
yes.
We're going to have to end it here. We've been talking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who has written a book called Blood on the Border, and she will be appearing Thursday night at 7:30 at the First Unitarian Church, which is in the Salmon Street Sanctuary. So it's at Southwest 12th and Salmon. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Live in the studio, Monday, May 15th, on the K-Boo Food Show. An interview with Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation. Tune in to hear about his new book, Chew on This, and you decide if it's too much to digest. That's 10 a.m., Monday, May 15th, on the K-Boo Food Show. See you there.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. It's a minute after 10 o'clock. Stay tuned at 10:30, stage and studio. Topics are Thicker Than Water, a festival of plays opening this Thursday, and for Asian Pacific Islander Heritage Month, a feature on the story of frontier herbalist Doc Hay. And now, Kathleen Stevenson and her guest, Ruth Curry, will discuss women and long-term care.